Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Liberté, liberté, liberté.
Resistance and more compliance as French President Macron lays down the law on COVID vaccines. Politician Nathalie Loiseau joins me on The Big Gamble. Then,
I am furious with myself.
Why?
Because I was not vaccinated.
In the United States, what if the unvaccinated can't be persuaded until it's too late? Journalist Ezra Klein joins us with that dire forecast. Plus,
the Delta variant in particular, it may be just a few minutes of exposure before you get infected.
The important things to know about the Delta variant. Walter Isaacson hears from the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. Also ahead, more twists and turns at the Olympics. Biles is back while a Belarusian athlete bolts.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Scientific fact states that while the COVID Delta variant is surging the world over, the most vulnerable are, of course, the unvaccinated. Yet, the panic can overwhelm everyone and bring normalization to a grinding halt. So, the race is on to get vaccines into reticent arms. In France, President Macron has taken the lead, taking a tough, no-dose, no-fun approach to pressure the holdouts, banning the undosed from theatres, restaurants, cinemas, and much more. And it seems to be working, because while there are protests, there is an even bigger surge in vaccine take-up. And France is now beating the United States, and it could even soon overtake the UK's highly successful rollout. More countries in Europe are now considering adopting the French method, and the Biden administration is already making vaccines mandatory for certain federal workers. Here to discuss her country's policy is the French member of the European Parliament, Nathalie Loiseau. Welcome back to the program. So just tell us first, what is it that finally tipped your president over the edge and made him do this mandate and bring in these vaccine passes and make it such a clear-cut, mandatory decision and policy?
Well, very simply, the Delta variant. We don't want to get back into lockdown. We don't want to close shops and restaurants and bars and cinemas. Now that the vaccine is available for everyone, starting at the age of 12, and there are plenty of vaccines throughout our country, plenty of places where you can get your jab. The idea is to give an incentive to people to get vaccinated. Therefore, there is this new health pass, which is you can enter a restaurant or a bar if you are vaccinated or if you tested negative or if you already had COVID and recovered. So you're not forced to vaccinate, but you prove that you're not contagious if you go into a public place.
So let's read some of the restrictions, all right? So the ones that are already in place starting from July 26 are for cinemas, nightclubs, museums, theatres, concerts and festivals, even zoos, swimming pools and sports facilities. No entry with no evidence, as you say, that you are not contagious. Now, in the next coming week, you also won't be able to go to cafes and restaurants, including outdoor terraces, to fairs, conferences, long-distance transport like airplanes and the TGV, which is the fast train, care homes and retirement homes, some medical establishments, except for emergency rooms. And also, you can't go to hotels and holiday resorts. You know, it's a lot of places you can't go. Are you surprised that there is protest in the street? And how do you balance the protest with whether or not this gamble is working?
Well, first of all, as you mentioned in your introduction, the gamble is working. Actually, a very vast number of people are getting vaccinated in France. More than 60% of adults 12 years old and above are vaccinated, two jabs, or at least are fully vaccinated in the country, which is really significant. So it's working, and many people who had simply waited, they had thought of getting vaccinated, but they were still sort of procrastinating their decision. Now they are getting vaccinated. But indeed, there are protests. And you should not downplay what's taking place as well. Some people very sincerely are fearful of the vaccine because they read or they heard so much disinformation, so many fake news for so many months that they got confused. And then you have also political exploitation of this fear or this confusion coming from the far left and the far right. And you always have, in my beloved home country, this sort of anti-authority culture, where a minority, which is not big, but a minority of people would protest any decision, whatever the decision might be.
So let's just get the figures so people fully understand what you've just told me. So this weekend, there were some 200,000 protesters across sort of various major cities in France. And there have been protests over the last several weeks since this announcement and also since your parliament passed an actual, you know, law to make this happen. But at the same time, you've had 4 million vaccines. I mean, the difference in numbers there is humongous. So you're right that the gamble is paying off. And you also say you must understand some of these people who are hesitant, who have been given fake news and the rest. But what about those like this person who just keep talking about liberty and this and that? Let's just play this soundbite.
I won't go to restaurants. I don't give a damn. I won't sell my soul to go to the cinema or for other nonsense. That's it. There is more at stake. Freedom.
So the president himself responds to some of this criticism by saying, what is your freedom worth if you say to me, I don't want to be vaccinated, but tomorrow you infect your father, your mother, or you infect me? How is he dealing and how is France dealing with this freedom thing, given it's right there in your, you know, declaration of existence on your coins and everywhere? Freedom, you know, fraternity and brotherhood.
Well, precisely on our coins and everywhere, you have freedom, you have equality, but you also have brotherhood. So you have to think not only about yourself, even if vaccination protects yourself, but also about others, about elderly, about vulnerable people. Not all of them were vaccinated. A number of them were in regions where the first wave of the pandemic was quite low. This is where I'm here, sitting now in the southwest of France. The first part of the pandemic was very, very, very low here in this region. So you have a number of elderly people who didn't think they should get vaccinated. They are vulnerable. They should get vaccinated, but thanks God, people like me are already vaccinated, so we can go and see them without being a danger for them. So fraternity, brotherhood is as important as freedom and liberty in the French DNA.
So the question then is, how do you enforce this policy? And let's just again state the facts and the polls, that this is a very popular move, despite the protests and despite what we hear. 62% of the French people in the latest poll favor health passes, while 70% approve of vaccine mandates for health workers. So that's pretty important. How does your country plan to enforce, or does it need to, because you're seeing the take-up happening? Do you feel you've got work to do to enforce it, or do you feel you've broken, you know, this holdout and actually a whole new floodgate of vaccine, take-up has opened?
Well, obviously, to be vaccinated now is easier than ever. You can be vaccinated on your place where you have holidays. You can be vaccinated in shopping malls. It's really simple. So I'm confident that more and more people are going to be vaccinated. For instance, for school pupils, it's not mandatory. But in case there is someone tested positive in a school, in a class, if you're vaccinated, you can go to the class. If you're not, you have to stay home. So it will be a strong incentive for young people to get vaccinated as well. But we still have to continue answering questions, fighting disinformation, which has been extremely strong on social media and still is, and also fighting or at least debating with politicians which don't show a lot of responsibility. They find it an opportunity to try to put pressure on Emmanuel Macron and the majority. And they are not really exercising their responsibility. You could say this is political life. You could say that's how it has to be 1 year before presidential election. But we are in the middle of a pandemic. So we have to be united and we have to be responsible.
You know, the same, you know, is happening in the United States. As you know, there's a whole group of political and other people who've been the holdouts and therefore threaten the rest of the health of the country. And it happens in other countries. You can see in Europe that there are others now looking to adopt the French method, whether it's Italy, which was one of the first to have a lockdown, one of the first to be so severely affected by COVID when it broke out. You can see various mandates for vaccines in some parts of Ireland and that economic sector. The question is, what has the holdout done physically for your country? Yes, the Delta variant is highly transmissible, but what has it done to the country right now? Because is it affecting the economy? It's not really sending healthy people or vaccinated people into the hospital. They generally get a lower level of case and certainly lower levels of death. What is the most frightening thing about Delta?
Well, obviously, people in the hospitals are not vaccinated. The 85% of people in hospitals right now with COVID are not vaccinated, which really shows the efficiency in the vaccine. But for instance, in overseas territories, in Guadeloupe, in Martinique, where the vaccination rate is very low, not higher than 20%, intensive care units are already overwhelmed. There is already a need to send patients to the mainland, to the French territory, because hospitals cannot deal with the Delta variant. So it can go very quickly. And it's not only elderly people who can get seriously struck by the COVID. So we don't want to get into one more lockdown. Our economy is recovering at a speedy pace. This is what we need. Our young generation wants to be able to live a normal life. And now that vaccine is available for everyone, this is precisely what we are trying to offer them, as normal a life as possible. And the health certificate really allows all of us. I went to a museum, I went to a cinema. It takes you 30 seconds to show your pass on a special app. I don't feel my liberty, I don't feel my freedom is being threatened. On the contrary, I'm living a normal life, which I was not able to live some months ago.
That's definitely the message to spread around. Nathalie Loiseau, thank you so much, French member of the European Parliament. Thank you very much. Now, as we said, the Delta surge in the United States is also causing alarm. And again, disease and death is chiefly amongst the unvaccinated. After lagging behind the rest of the U.S., southern, mostly red states are now boosting their own vaccination numbers, but it's still not enough. While half of the U.S. population is fully vaccinated now, millions are not getting their doses. Now, in a speech last week, President Joe Biden remarked on the resentment building up.
America's divided between the majority of eligible people who are vaccinated and those who are not. And I understand that many of you in the majority are frustrated with the consequences of the failure of the minority to get vaccinated. But I want you to know that I'm going to continue to do everything I can to encourage the unvaccinated to get vaccinated. That includes addressing hesitancy and misinformation head on.
The U.S. government is still trying to raise vaccine enthusiasm with treats and perks. But my next guest asks, what if the unvaccinated can't be persuaded? That is the title of Ezra Klein's latest column for The New York Times. And he's joining me now with some answers. Ezra Klein, welcome to the program. Can I ask you the democracy question, the minority-majority question, because you work a lot on that. You heard what I was talking about with the French member of parliament. You just heard me play what President Biden has said. How long can a population, a majority, put up with a holdout minority, a significant minority, being mollycoddled, being coddled at the expense of the majority?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure I think about it exactly like that, because you're dealing with a lot of states. This is very local, the way it's playing out. You have places like where I live in San Francisco, very, very, very heavily vaccinated, and you have places in the country that have a majority who aren't vaccinated. You have very different political trends around this. So, you know, in California, the state government is creating basically a vaccine mandate for state employees. In Florida, the governor there is considered a likely Republican presidential candidate in 2024, is making it illegal for individual employers to have their own vaccine mandates. So part of what's happening here is you have very different situations in different counties and in different states. And it is the collision of these differing majorities, these differing publics, these differing political constituencies, it ends up really mattering here. But as people often say, the virus does not care about your party affiliation. The virus does not care about your ideology. The virus is happy to infect the Republicans and Democrats alike. So one of America's great weaknesses in this entire pandemic is our political division.
So you just addressed it, and you mentioned Florida and a potential presidential candidate. We hear, I read in your newspaper, that hospital admissions in Miami are surging. They're at very high levels right now. And you saw, or at least the nation saw, that by his own people's admission, President Trump lost the election chiefly around his mishandling, the perception of his mishandling COVID. Do you think a Governor DeSantis will stick to this, you know, banning private enterprise and companies from having their own vaccine mandates, even as we see Republicans around the country now stepping out more loudly to urge vaccine take up?
I've wondered about this. I mean, I think some of it is going to depend on the reality of the situation, how much Delta fills the morgues and the ICUs in Florida. One problem with DeSantis is he has built a lot of his public reputation and his profile on trying to walk a line between not being entirely anti-science on this, but also being a champion of those skeptical of lockdowns and vaccination mandates, right? Trying to represent a kind of merged traditional conservatism and a skeptical Trumpian conspiratorial conservatism. And that's a hard thing to hold together when reality won't cooperate. So we're going to see. The thing that I still cannot quite believe that he did was not allow private employers to put these policies down themselves. Yeah. I don't think we can sustain at this point a national vaccine mandate, but I think a lot of individual employers are doing them, should be doing them. That's a good first step and middle ground for now. And for Republicans to turn against that, I mean, even the Wall Street Journal said that's ridiculous. You need to let employers have the policies that make sense for them.
I thought that was a very conservative, philosophy to let private enterprise, frankly, be private enterprise and do practically, you know, what they want. They're not bound by federal law, I guess. So it is weird. You're absolutely right. It is weird. You say you don't see the possibility of a national mandate, a federal mandate. What do you make, though? What do you think America could learn from what the French president has done? He's also a conservative. I mean, you know, he's not a raging liberal. He's a centrist conservative. And he's done something that was a gamble, and it seems to be paying off. Do you think America could ever do anything similar?
I think we can at least learn from it. So I'll note something that is important to look at for Americans in France. The beginning of July, France lags behind us in share of the adult population, simply share of the entire population vaccinated. By the end of July, which is, by the way, before this is passed into law, they're just talking about it during this period, the acceleration in vaccination signups had boosted France well ahead of America in share of the population being vaccinated. So it actually does work to talk about this. One reason I wrote my piece, one reason I'm glad to see how much conversation there is among big employers, among public employers, is I do think simply talking about this and making people think this is something that is probably going to come, at least in some of the things they frequent in their lives, is really important and worth doing. I'm not against a vaccine mandate. I'd like to see one happen. I'm worried that we cannot currently sustain it. And so I think you need middle steps before we, if we do end up making the choice to go all the way there, before we get there. For instance, you actually need to build a really strong infrastructure for how you are able to show that medical record to people. I've covered many digital initiatives in the government, and sometimes they don't work that well, like healthcare.gov. So this question of what if you lost the card you got when you initially got vaccinated? What if they entered your information wrong? What if you don't have a smartphone? It's to do a policy at the scale of a vaccination mandate, you really have to be able to pull it off with almost a seamless transition period. There's got to be people you can call if it's not working for you, you can get on the phone, the tests need to be available. So I would like to see very big employers and public employers like the government doing this for their staffs, building up the digital and technical and testing infrastructure so that then if we decide as a country we need to move in this direction nationally, you know, in a couple of weeks or months, we actually have the ability to do it.
Again, you know, I'm listening to what you're saying, and I hear if we decide we need to do it in a couple of weeks or months. I mean, this has been the, you know, the sort of design of this whole problem in America of the response is just waiting to see what happens, as if that's some kind of miracle solution when we know what happens if one waits and doesn't do anything. But I want to read a little bit from your article that we were talking about, which is what if the unvaccinated cannot be persuaded? You wrote, we do not solely rely on argumentation to persuade people to wear seatbelts. A majority of states do not leave it to individual debaters to hash out whether you can smoke in indoor workplaces. Polio and measles were murderous, but their near elimination required vaccine mandates, not just public education. And when George Washington himself wanted to protect his soldiers from smallpox, he made inoculations mandatory. It worked. So again, it is about telling the story and the right narrative. You know, it worked once. What is it that's not working now? Particularly as you say, what if they'll never be persuaded until it's too late?
So there are a couple of groups here. One, the complicated part of this is you need to be able to enforce the policy. And one, because of the way we fracture authority throughout the government into state governments and into local governments, the federal government has some authority to do this. But what are we actually saying for enforcement here in a world where that would be highly polarizing and going into states like Florida that have actually made it illegal to do something like that in state law? Are we going to send National Guard troops in to enforce it? Are we going to throw people in jail? So one of the reasons I'm a little cautious about talking about these policies is sometimes I think we make a mistake in the policy conversation about pretending that simply putting something into law will make it happen. Right now, I do not see stomach or capability to enforce it. And as of yet, we haven't shown that we can even do the basic record keeping necessary to do it well. So I would like to see us build towards something like that. Again, if we need to get there, time is not going to solve anything, but nor is a policy that fundamentally doesn't work. And so you need to build things. You need to try to build public support. But if you cannot, well, then we have much harder choices in this country. When you look at the people who are not vaccinated right now, so we've been talking about share of the population, but I think it's better to actually look at people over 18. So it's about 69%, I believe, of Americans over 18 have been vaccinated with at least one dose. And if you break that down even further, Kaiser Family Foundation does these numbers. About half of those folks say they are still in the wait and see camp. So they're not definitely not going to get vaccinated. They just haven't done it yet. They're not sure. Another group, about 6% of the country, is saying they would only get vaccinated under some kind of mandate. But that implies that if there is some kind of mandate, including just from local employers, bars, et cetera, that might convert a bunch of them. And then I think it's still 14 percentage points of the country say they will not get vaccinated under any circumstances. And that's where you might get into these folks who there is a real kind of collision with. So I think that there are middle steps that could get us basically halfway there. And if we got halfway there, that would be a big deal at this point.
Yeah. And just to ask a last question on the COVID issue, Dr. Fauci was on, obviously, the Sunday programs, and he gave a shout out to a lot of the Republicans who are now stepping forth. Let's just play what he said.
I'm also gratified by seeing that even people who in the beginning were reluctant to promote vaccination are now doing it. I mean, people like Republicans, like Stephen Scalise, or even Governor DeSantis talking about getting people vaccinated. Asa Hutchinson out there beating the bushes, getting people to get vaccinated. I think that's what's happening now.
Just your assessment of, you know, given your knowledge of American politics, do you think that more of those people like the ones he names who come out and, you know, basically change their tune about the vaccine will actually influence a significant number of people?
I'm certainly hoping so. I mean, Sarah Huckabee Sanders is out there telling people it's the Trump vaccine and getting it as a way to thumb your nose at the lockdowns that Anthony Fauci and the Democrats and the media want. And you know what? Speaking as a member of the media, I applaud her. Like, if she wants to get people to take the vaccine as a way of sticking it to me, I sure hope she succeeds. Listen, I don't think Republicans want their constituents to die. And a lot of them will if you keep seeing this huge vaccination gap among Democrats and Republicans. I think Democrats are over 80%, Republicans at about 52%. That's a lot of vulnerability in their own constituencies. And as Delta begins to rip through the population, it's a lot of people who are going to be hurt and harmed. I hope Republican politicians stand up and do the right things here. They have in the past on public health. It is not un-Republican somehow to believe that we should treat public health as a collective endeavor. And it is, I think, more than anything else, a hangover of Donald Trump's inconsistency and erratic nature on this. Look, Warp Speed, the vaccine acceleration project, that was a Donald Trump policy. He could have been out there every single day taking a victory lap on this. Weirdly, he always seemed more excited about cures that didn't work, like hydrochloroquine, than the cures that he actually helped usher into existence that really do protect people from the illness. It's a very, very, very strange way Republican politics fell out here. But there's another world that's very possible where Republicans see the accelerated vaccines as a huge policy accomplishment and are barnstorming the country to get people to take them. Maybe they can catch up to that politics now.
Mm-hmm. You know, you say weirdly, I fully agree with you. I've never fully understood. They say he could have won the election had he just taken ownership of the vaccines, had his vaccine, showed it, you know, shown the people, you know, what could be done and what was done under his administration in terms of that particular piece of it. So let's just take that attitude and move on to politics, democracy. Your latest podcast was a fascinating conversation between Nicole Hannah-Jones and Ta-Nehisi Coates about race, about the nature of America, and about, you know, where the actual truth, I guess, lies in terms of moving forward. So if you see, as we all do, these politics and, you know, being played with something like a vaccine and a disease, how do you see and what was your discussion about where, you know, America's story will come out? You know, the idea of democracy. If people can't believe basic science and gather around sort of basic facts, what do you in your conversations feel about how the country will deal with history, with try to solidify a fragile democracy?
I mean, not well. So one of the pieces of that conversation with Ta-Nehisi and Nicole Hannah-Jones is one thing we're discussing is a mistaken impression Americans have of their own history is that we are a deeply small-D democratic country. I mean, you will hear that we're the world's oldest democracy, which is true in a certain way, in a very attenuated definition of democracy from, you know, a couple hundred years ago. But we did not have anything like a democracy in which most adults were treated mostly equally by the political system until after the civil rights movement in the 60s. So, I mean, we're talking about a couple decades ago. We're talking about, you know, the lifetime of many people alive today. To the extent America is in any respect a multi-ethnic democracy, that is shallow soil we are rooted in. And so a lot of the fights we're having over whether or not we're going to expand or constrict the franchise, it's very important to start with the recognition that it would be not a break from America's historical traditions to have wide-scale voter suppression or disenfranchisement, but it would actually be in concert with them, in alignment with them. It would be how the country has been for most of its existence, which means actually there's much reason to worry that these fights are truly real, that anytime you are trying to pull a country back into a historical alignment, you are in some ways going to face less opposition than if you're trying to graft something totally new onto it. And at least in one telling, making America a true multi-ethnic democracy would be bringing America into being something new, something it has not traditionally been. So how will our fractured empirical reality play into this? I mean, not well. But on the other hand, it is not the case that at other points in American history, agreement has been furnished, right? We did not agree on getting rid of slavery. We did not agree on the civil rights movement. We did not agree on giving women the vote. I mean, you had suffragettes who were committing street vandalism to do that. You had them beaten by the police. So conflict over what kind of democracy will be is nothing new. And nor is conspiratorial thinking, nor is political opposition. These are fights, unfortunately, that have to be fought and have to be won if the country is going to move forward.
Indeed. And I just want to play this soundbite from Mitch McConnell, Senate Minority Leader, about what the election of Barack Obama, he thought, said about the United States.
I don't think reparations for something that happened 150 years ago, for whom none of us currently living are responsible, is a good idea. We've, you know, tried to deal with our original sin of slavery by fighting a civil war, by passing landmark civil rights legislation. We've elected an African-American president. I think we're always a work in progress in this country, but no one currently alive was responsible for that.
So your guests, Nicole and Ta-Nehisi, had a lot to say about that point. I just want to know your view, your final thought about what he said about electing a black president.
Nicole Anna Jones had a great point in our conversation where she said she talked to a lot of voters after the 2016 election, and something they said was that they had felt that America had elected a black president, and that meant they were going to stop hearing about racial inequality. They were going to stop hearing about how hard it was for black people. And when that didn't happen, they felt betrayed, and that's part of the reason they turned to Donald Trump. I think you're hearing that strain of sentiment in American life voiced there by Mitch McConnell, that Barack Obama wasn't supposed to be part of the country moving towards racial equality. It was supposed to be the end of having to hear about that, for him, I guess, annoying topic.
As you say, America is a work in progress. Ezra Klein, thank you so much indeed. So we have been discussing the spread, the fear, and the search for solutions over this COVID and Delta variant. But what do we really know about the science behind it? Well, a recent internal document from the CDC reveals that it is as contagious as chickenpox, and it increases the risk of severe illness and hospitalization, as we know. Michael Osterholm is the director for infectious disease research and policy at the University of Minnesota. Here he is speaking to Walter Isaacson about how the United States should respond and what can be learned from other countries.
Thank you, Christian and Dr. Michael Osterholm. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
I'm down here in New Orleans. Like much of the country, we're fighting the Delta variant that's come along. But that Delta variant, it sprung up in India and raged through the country and then subsided. And it seems it's doing the same in England. Is there a chance that variants like this just burn themselves out?
One of the observations we've had with COVID-19 and SARS-CoV-2 specifically, the virus, is it seems to want to run sprints and not marathons. And what I mean by that is we have a whole overlapping set of these kind of whack-a-mole sprint moments, country by country. Just this past week, Iran is in its fifth surge and reporting the highest number of cases it's had since the beginning of the pandemic. I could go country by country, region by region, and show you the same thing, that without regard to necessarily what the humans do, you'll see these big surges of cases, often lasting 5 to 8 weeks, and then it just ends, even though there are still, as I say, a lot of human wood for this coronavirus forest fire to burn. And then it starts back up again later. And we don't understand that. And I think that one of the challenges we have in public health prevention and messaging to the public is to help them understand just that.
You just said that it happens, it surges and then recedes, irrespective at times of what humans do. Does that mean that we should just all get vaccinated but not worry quite so much about shutdowns and mask mandates?
Well, first of all, again, we have to look at what can we really do about the virus. Clearly, if we are not in contact with others, we're not going to get infected, nor are we going to transmit the virus. So distancing can play a key role, regardless of whether the virus is going to do its sprint or a marathon. I've had concerns, and it dates back to April of 2020, about the concept of masking. Needless to say, it is a political hot button beyond anything I've ever seen in public health. And yet at the same time, I think we've all done a disservice to the public. When you actually look at face cloth coverings, those cloth pieces of hang over your face, they actually only have very limited impact in reducing the amount of virus that you inhale in or exhale out. And in fact, in studies that have been done show that if an individual might get infected within 15 minutes in a room, by time and concentration of the virus in the room, if you add a face cloth covering on, you only get about 5 more minutes of protection. And so I've been really, unfortunately, really disappointed in my colleagues in public health for not being more clear about what can masking do or not do. On the other hand, if you use the N95 respirators and you fit them tight to your face, you can actually spend 25 hours in that same room and still be protected.
But so, we're not gonna all be using N95, right? I mean, I got my mask here with the Saints logo on it. I mean, it seems that we can't just do that.
Well, you know, it's not about what you can and can't do. It's the science is first, and then we have to understand. Then you can decide what you can and can't do. The bottom line, though, is by telling people that, in fact, just putting a face cloth covering on is going to protect you, it's just simply not true. So when you ask what can you do, if you don't want to put an N95 on or you feel like you can't, then that's your choice. But the bottom line is putting your face cloth covering on is only going to provide you limited protection. The same is true how you wear it. We've been doing surveys on television screenshots of news media events, looking at how many people are wearing a face cloth covering or a mask or whatever. But then more importantly, how do they wear it? 25% of the population consistently since the beginning of the pandemic wear it under their nose. That's like fixing 3 of the 5 screen doors in your submarine. You know, it's just ridiculous. If you're going to wear it, actually wear it to try to maximize your protection. So we can do something about it. Distancing works. Efficient and effective respiratory protection works. And most of all, vaccine works. So there's a lot we still can do.
If we have protection against serious illness, even if the virus starts to spread, isn't that going to help solve this if enough of us just don't get all that sick if the virus spreads and it's a little bit like a mild case of the flu?
You know, that's a critical point. I'm quoted in a New Yorker article posted yesterday, just that very piece about the fact that we have to understand how much we've still gained from these vaccines. It's been remarkable in the reduction in the number of deaths. And if you look at England, if you look at Israel, that's the case. The one thing, however, we have to be very careful of again, and this again is trying to see into the future. I every morning, the first thing I do, I get up and try to scrape the 4 inches of mud off my crystal ball and then go to work. And in this case, if we look at what's happened in Israel, what they have found is a rather rapid reduction in the prevention against serious illness after 6 months. So even there, we are seeing now this waning immunity having an impact on whether you get serious illness or not, which is all the reason why you're going to keep hearing much more in the days ahead about booster doses. That's why the Israelis have now initiated booster doses for those over 60 years of age and those who have underlying immune conditions. And I think that's what's going to happen here. Then we may be able to maintain that high level of protection against serious illness and deaths, which by itself would be a tremendous gift in terms of fighting this virus.
You've mentioned social distancing. How realistic is it today to get us back to social distancing? Does it mean we have to try to do shutdowns again?
Well, first of all, when we talk about social distancing, we have to understand that today it has a different meaning than it did at the beginning of the pandemic when people thought it was just the 6-foot distance, that all you had to do, that if it was transmitted by what we call respiratory droplets, those kind of boulders that come out of our mouths and our nose when we speak or cough or sneeze, and they fall within 6 feet of us. Today, that's not the science that we know. We know these are transmitted with aerosols. If you want to know the difference, all those plexiglass plates you saw that were put up that supposedly separated you from me with 6 feet have no real purpose today at all. The aerosols, to understand, really are the best way I can tell people to do it. If you're in a room with someone and they're smoking and you smell it, you're getting basically inhaled aerosols in. You're walking down the street. You know, I just had this happen to me this past weekend where all of a sudden I smelled cigarette smoke and I looked around and I was downwind from somebody 20 feet from me on the side of the sidewalk smoking. And now, in that case, you wouldn't likely get infected from just that exposure. It's a time concentration. But we now have evidence that with the Delta variant in particular, it may be just a few minutes of exposure before you get infected. So when I say social distance, I'm talking about you do have to be apart from someone sufficiently that you wouldn't smell their cigarette smoke. Now, that's a lot longer than 6 feet in most cases. So what does that mean? Well, it means everybody can't do that. We don't have that much space in the world, and people aren't going to do it on mass transit. They're not going to do it in grocery stores, etc. So then I say, well, how likely is it if you get infected, you might have a very serious illness? Are you older? What is your body weight? Do you have underlying immune deficiencies or immune suppression because of the drugs you're taking or a health condition you might have? And then I say, you don't want to be around people for any period of time without an N95 respirator on, and in fact, that distance. So I don't think it's going to apply to the general public. It just can't happen. It won't happen. And that's the challenge we have today.
Are you concerned about recent studies that show cognitive problems of people who've had COVID?
I don't think anyone really yet understands the legacy of COVID-19 well into generations ahead. I think the issues around long COVID or long haulers is going to be a very substantial issue. And I think the cognitive dysfunction is going to be part of it. I think that there's going to be much, much more coming from this fight between our body's immune systems and this virus and what it's done to all the rest of our body. You know, we're like a castle that has been taking incoming from this virus, and then we fought back, and in the process, we both did damage to our castle. And so I think that this is a challenge, and I do worry a lot about these long hauler-like conditions, which cognitive dysfunction is one of them.
Do you think it would be a good idea just to push as hard as we possibly can to convince, and in some cases, nudge people to get vaccinated and forget about all the other peripheral stuff that we don't even quite know if it works?
Well, I think, again, vaccine is at the very foundational aspects of anything we do to change this pandemic. Let me just say, though, I've been in this business 46 years. I have spent my career promoting vaccines. I actually helped write the legislation here in Minnesota back in the 1980s to mandate vaccines in institutions of higher education. You know, I have been in the forefront of this, and I've never seen anything like this before. Please do not tell me lessons learned from childhood immunizations and apply them here, because they just don't apply. This is a different situation. We have three groups of people today. They're the vaccine affirmative. These are the people that drove 120 miles in February snowstorms to find vaccine in a clinic in some remote town. They couldn't wait to get it. Then we have the vaccine hesitant, the group that at this point, they have still legitimate concerns. This isn't a licensed vaccine. I am a pregnant woman. I am a member of the Black community who has been experimented upon by government. And this was Operation Warp Speed, and it's not a licensed vaccine. All really legitimate questions. And then there's the third group, the vaccine hostile. These are the people who under no conditions will be vaccinated, at least in any way against their will. And they're a group that in many cases don't even believe the pandemic's real, et cetera. The vaccine hostile, we're never going to get. You know, whatever they have to do to not get vaccinated, they will do it. It's the vaccine hesitant right now that we need to really focus on and convert those people to vaccine recipients. And we're actually making progress there. And, you know, the more information we get on the vaccines in terms of towards licensure, I think this is going to help a lot. You know, we do have these stops and starts. The last 72 hours, I've taken a number of questions from people who said, wait, no. Why would I get this vaccine now? Because I can still transmit the virus. And so, you know, we have to go through all of it to lay out why this is still a very important tool, what that means. But I think it's that vaccine hesitant group that if we can come bring them along, that's going to be a group that will be very important.
All right. I want you to look into the camera and give a great one sentence pitch to a vaccine hesitant person.
If you don't care about yourself, you can say, I don't need this vaccine. I'm strong enough. But if you care about the ones you love, your friends, your family, your colleagues, your mother and father, grandfather, your kids, you'll get this vaccine.
Should restaurants require vaccines?
I would say every place right now. I do that. I, for example, though, have not supported a vaccine mandate at our own institution, the University of Minnesota. And the reason for that is because in Minnesota law, the way vaccine exemptions are set up in our public institutions, you have to offer deferments for medical reasons and for philosophical reasons. So all I have to do is sign a sheet of paper and say, I'm done, I'm not getting it, have it notarized, and I'm exempt. And if we put a mandate in place today, we have heard from some of those very communities I just mentioned, the Black community said, if you mention the word mandate, we're done, we're out, we're going to sign off, we're not going to get it. We need time to bring these people along. Remember, this isn't a campaign like we use for childhood immunizations where it may take us years before we're able to get vaccine levels up. Look at even in adults with vaccines like shingles or HPV, how long it's taken us to get people to actually take the vaccine. Here we're now expecting in just a few months for that to happen. If we put in place a mandate in our state, in colleges and universities, we're going to see a lot of people sign that exemption and we will never get them back. And those are the ones we're trying to get to on board. So I think there's a time and place for mandates. I have to say, you know, when I started here in Minnesota back in the mid-1970s, it was at the heyday of the Indoor Air Acts and clean air. And we heard from bars and restaurants around this state, oh my God, if you put in place non-smoking, we're done. We're cooked. We can't make it. Well, it turned out people had forgotten that 30% of smokers were very different than the 70% of people who didn't smoke. And they couldn't wait to get to a bar or restaurant that was actually smoke-free. And business went up. And so I think right now, if you had restaurants and bars, you had venues where people were required to be vaccinated and show that, that you would actually see participation substantially increase beyond anything else. I'd feel safe to go there today. I wouldn't feel safe to go to a restaurant today where that wasn't the case.
The music venues here in New Orleans have all just decided to say you need to show on your phone your vaccine, you know, that you're vaccinated, whether it's Preservation Hall or DBA or Tipitina's. And that's caused an uptick in people getting vaccinated. They want to go hear music. Does that make sense?
I love that. I think that's the incentive piece. You know, there's two ways to go at this. There's vinegar and there's honey. And, you know, wherever you can use honey, we have shown in public health time and time again, it's the most effective way to go.
You say that the single most important thing we can do to protect our health in face of this virus is to get vaccinated. What about children, young children?
Young children right now are a challenge. We have to acknowledge that. We need to get vaccine for those children. You know, these studies can't get done quick enough. But also, Walter, you know, one of the challenges I have, and I don't know what the answer is, and this is one of those issues of humility, is the fact that here we are talking about the riches of the high-income countries are debating whether to have a booster dose, a third dose. And we have 6.4 million people living in low- and middle-income countries, and less than 2% of them have had access to any doses. And, you know, we can surely make an argument on a humanitarian basis the critical need to get vaccine to these countries. But also, in a very important way, is the fact that these new variants are not as likely to come spinning out of a smaller population experience like the United States, but they surely could spin out in large numbers in these infections among the 6.4 billion people living in low and middle income countries. So it's in our strategic interest to get vaccine to these countries, just to try to preserve and protect the integrity of our vaccines today. So, you know, I think we have a lot of work to do, as I've said, and from your perspective as a historian and an expert in this, we need a Manhattan Project now to make vaccines. We need a whole lot of Marshall plans to get it delivered.
And do you think very young children, they should be authorized now to be vaccinated?
I don't think the data are there yet to provide the satisfactory safety information that are going to be required. We're going to have a hard time getting parents to buy this vaccine for their kids for a number of them. Some parents can't get it quick enough, but there are going to be a lot of parents, and I've seen the kind of communications from these parents to say, no way are my kids going to get vaccinated. They're not going to be an experiment. And so, again, this is going to be our challenge is we're going to have schools where some kids will be vaccinated, some kids won't. We have to anticipate that now. What can we do now to help basically provide the support, the education, the information? The other thing I think that's happening that is a game changer is in the first year of the pandemic, right up through the time when the alpha variants really started to emerge, we did see a very different epidemiology of infection in kids. It was much less infectious. Kids did not transmit nearly as readily between themselves or to others, or did they get infected? We didn't see nearly the same spectrum of serious illness. That all changed with Alpha. And now with Delta, it's even been accentuated. And so I think that one of the things we have to understand is the data that we had a year ago on kids and infection doesn't hold up today. And the data today says kids are at a lot higher risk of getting infected, of transmitting the virus, and potentially even having serious illness.
Dr. Michael Osterholm, as always, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Walter.
And finally, despite COVID also in Japan, there have been dramatic developments at the Olympics. Instead of competing, Belarusian sprinter Kristina Tymanowskaya is at the Polish embassy right now seeking political asylum after a dust-up with her coaches and the nation's authoritarian president over which race she competes in. And the other big story, of course, is Simone Biles, who's returning to compete for a gold medal after having pulled out of some events last week. Correspondent Selena Wang joins us from Tokyo with more. Selena, it is extraordinary. Everybody's been focusing on Simone Biles. What's the mood there? Is there that sense of anticipation about her coming back, what she might achieve tomorrow?
Christian, absolutely. This is a very high-stakes return for Simone Biles. This would be her last opportunity to take home gold at these Olympics after withdrawing from several events, saying she wanted to focus on her mental health. Now she is returning to the balance beam. But, however, Christian, as early as Friday, she had posted on Instagram that she was still dealing with this mental block that gymnasts call the twisties. She said she literally could not tell up from down and that it was terrifying to try skills without her mind and body sinking together. However, balance beam requires less of the twisting, so it could be more manageable given that she is still dealing with this mental block. But I have to say that the reception among other athletes here, as well as much of the public, has been incredibly positive. Simone Biles may have pulled back, but she has sparked this global conversation about mental health among elite athletes. She is being applauded for having the courage to know when to step back to protect herself, because people recognize that gymnastics is a dangerous sport and that when she is not mentally in the right state, it could have serious repercussions for her physical abilities. And Christian, she's definitely not holding back. I was at the individual event finals on Sunday and I could hear her all the way across the stands cheering on her teammates, standing up, taking on this role almost of coach as well.
It is extraordinary, and we've all been following it so closely. That twisty that you've just been talking about makes sense, but it is extraordinary, and it's only them who can feel that. They're the ones in the air who've got to figure out that they have the mental and physical, you know, confidence to land that maneuver. But as for Japan, and you've been talking to some of the athletes, particularly the swimmer, it despite COVID, it's been very well received, the games in Japan, despite obviously the problems this year and the year's delay. Talk to us about how the athletes there are viewing their own Olympics.
It's been very interesting and very tough on the athletes. I've been living in Tokyo since last year, and I've been talking to residents all the time, regularly, leading up to this moment. And there was so much immense opposition, frustration among people, among anti-Olympic protesters, that the government was pouring so many resources into a global sporting event when so many in Japan and around the world were still suffering from COVID-19. And Japan has also had a very slow vaccine rollout. And as of today, still less than a third of the population has been fully vaccinated. But after that Olympic opening ceremony happened, we have seen that opposition start to soften. I spoke to the CEO of Olympic Broadcasting Services, who told me that 90% of the Japanese public has watched some part of the games on TV since they started. And when I speak to residents, I certainly feel that they are becoming inspired by these incredible performances from athletes around the world, including their own nation's athletes. Japan has had a stunning run at the Olympics, taking home already a record number of Olympic golds. And I spoke to Yui Ohashi. She is a swimmer and the first Japanese woman to take home multiple gold medals at the same Olympics. Take a listen to what she told me.
We, the athletes, went to the Olympics with a great deal of confusion. But I've received a lot of comments from people who said they were moved by athletes winning gold medals and other medals, seeing athletes trying so hard, so I'm very happy about that. It was a miracle for me to participate in the Olympic Games in my own country. So it was a big event for me, and I hope I was able to inspire people. It might be strange to say this, but inspire those who were against the games or people who were not so interested in sports. And I hope I've encouraged them even a bit.
Christian, I think it's important to note that this excitement for the athletes and support for the athletes also comes with difficult mixed emotions. I still speak to many who say they don't think it's the right time to celebrate. They're worried about the surge in COVID-19 cases in Japan. Cases in Tokyo have been reaching regular record highs. Tokyo is still under a state of emergency, and COVID-19 cases within the Olympic bubble have also been increasing.
It's really so interesting. Thanks for bringing it to us from Tokyo, Selena Wang. Thank you so much. And just as we leave you, we want to say that Italy's been having a very good 2021. Not only did they win the Eurovision Song Contest and the Euro Final, but they created Italian Olympic history with the highest jumping man who won in the high jump and also the world's fastest man. They both had the most amazing Olympics, and the Italian Olympic Committee says the greatest day in Italian sports history. And on that lovely note, that is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking. Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.